Thank you for joining us. My name is Katie Heinle, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make it fishery science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're the generous sort, you can support the podcast on Patreon with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. Today, I'm interviewing Dr. Michael Quist. Mike is an assistant unit leader with the Idaho Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit and professor in the Department of Fish and Wildlife Sciences at the University of Idaho. Prior to joining the unit program in 2010, he was an assistant professor at Iowa State University for about 5 years. His research is highly applied and largely focuses on questions of interest to natural resource professionals. He is particularly interested in the aging growth of fishes, harvest management, and fish population ecology. He has also connected research focused on patterns in fish assemblage structure across a variety of systems. For fun, Mike enjoys all things outdoors, hunting, backpacking, fishing with his wife and two daughters, especially for giant steelhead, chip carving, woodworking, and leg day. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Thanks, Katie. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. So I always like to start kind of with, where did your interest in fisheries begin?
Yeah, you know, I think like a lot of folks, I think there are lots of paths that people get to this point. I think the common denominator is we all enjoyed angling at some point or spending time on the water. And that's certainly the case with me. And I think I've been an angler for almost as long as I can remember. Lots of early memories with my dad and my uncles in particular. And so, yeah, I've always been interested in fisheries. And my uncle, one of my uncles, was a game warden, a CEO with Idaho Fish and Game, actually. And when I was probably 10 years old, I got to spend a couple weeks with him and got to do all kinds of, you know, fun things like tagging fish and things that CEOs do. And, you know, at the time I actually thought I wanted to be a CEO, but I'm colorblind. So my ideas of going into law enforcement were squashed pretty quickly. So anyway, I really enjoyed math. I enjoyed science, all of those things. And I knew that being a biologist was something that would be of interest to me. And so, yeah, I was at a pretty young age. I think I knew I wanted to go in fish or wildlife. You know, it wasn't until I got a little bit older that really fisheries started to resonate with me. And yeah, and then from there, yeah, as you mentioned, I finished up and then I was really on the fence. I grew up in Western Washington. And so I had opportunities to go to the University of Washington. And I was also looking at the University of Idaho. I really didn't want to live in Seattle. So I grew up in kind of a small town. So I had zero desire to live in Seattle. And I was really interested in, you know, resident fish, not so much on marine systems, which the UW was really focused on. And so, yeah, I ended up coming to the UI for my undergraduate. And yeah, just a great experience.
Awesome. So what drew you to more of a research path rather than the straight up biologist path?
Yeah, well, I think what may be helpful, I'll just kind of tell you a little bit of kind of how I got to where I am. Cause I think honestly, that story tells a lot about kind of how I think about things and some of the things I'm interested in. So as I mentioned, I came here to the University of Idaho for my bachelor's degree. It was a great, you know, really great experience. I worked pretty much during the academic years for Idaho Fish and Game and the summers for Idaho Fish and Game, primarily over in Idaho Falls, which is like the epicenter of all things trout, you know? So if you're a trout angler, like that's the place to be. And so I had a great experience there, had a great experience with American Fisheries Society here as an undergraduate, got really engaged professionally. And so just had some really good mentors that kind of, you know, really got me engaged in fisheries. So when I was looking at graduate school and looking at graduate school programs, and I knew pretty quickly that I needed to go to grad school. I'll be honest with you. I wanted to get out of the West, which is kind of awkward. Most people don't have that perspective, but I was looking at a lot of the issues that were facing a lot of Western systems and looking at introductions of smallmouth bass and walleye and pike and those kinds of things. I felt like I needed a better background in that, truthfully. You know, my whole world was, I mean, I grew up catching salmon and steelhead. I went to the University of Idaho. It was very much focused on anadromous fishes, as well as resident salmonids. Largely my work experience was largely with salmonids. And so I wanted to get that just hardcore Midwestern fish management background. And so I applied to pretty much every, not every, this is that, that's not quite fair. I sat down with my advisor here at the UI and identified some good people to work with. Most of them at the time with my interest were with the co-op unit program in the Midwest. I also applied to Montana State, interestingly enough, because that was kind of our family school. Mm-hmm. So that was just to appease my folks. But anyway, I ended up, going to Kansas State University. And there was a fairly young professor there with the co-op unit named Chris Guy, who is now at Montana State. And he and I just really hit it off. Like the things he was doing, the work that he was doing were things that were really of interest to me. And he had a project mm-hmm. that was focused on abiotic and biotic factors and how those influence fish assemblages and populations on Fort Riley Military Reservation. So those things will come up later, this abiotic, biotic, relationships in both populations and assemblages were part of that project. And I'll be honest with you, it wasn't kind of what I had envisioned for a research project. Like it wasn't like hardcore fish management stuff, or at least I didn't think it was, mm-hmm. but it turned out to be very much that, we were looking at military training activities. So at Fort Riley, it's mechanized infantry. So like tanks. And so looking at how military training influenced habitat, and then in turn, how did that influence assemblage structure and population? So it was really, really, really cool. And in hindsight, like I could not ask for a better project. It was so far out of my wheelhouse and what I thought was going to be, something that I'd be interested in. But in the end, it was really, I couldn't think of anything, more formative than that. Yeah, so when I was at K-State, I started doing research. Chris really promoted side projects, really kind of based on the interests of, the interests of the students. I do the same thing, and that's a whole different discussion. But I did a bunch of work on shovelnose sturgeon and channel catfish and blue catfish and a lot of agent growth work. It was just really in the weeds, Midwestern fish management stuff. And I really enjoyed it. And so, your question about research, like that's really, I kind of went there thinking, okay, I need to learn something about these, techniques with management, some of these species, how people do it on the other, other parts of the country. How do we work with these systems? And I did that. And I will say, I when I came into it, I was really thinking I was going to come back to the West, bring all this information that I'd learned. That was kind of my goal, mm-hmm. was to come back West and, use these things I learned and apply that to systems out here. In the end, I have, but kind of not in the way that I thought. And so, during my master's, I really enjoyed research, and I was kind of good at it. So the other part, I guess, that I'll mention is that at Kansas State University, they kind of have a weird system where whether you're an RA or a TA, it doesn't really matter. You teach every semester.
Huh.
I taught all kinds of stuff, mm-hmm. general biology courses as well, or TA'd, I should say, as well as several fish classes. That's also the time where I got my first taste of mentoring, working with some undergraduates mm-hmm. on some research projects. And so I guess the point is that I enjoyed research. I enjoyed teaching. I really enjoyed mentoring. I was fairly decent at it. And so, the opportunity, I was kind of thinking about what I'm going to do. And Chris and I started talking about a PhD project and continuing on. And that's exactly what I did. And I decided to stay on with Chris, and that was a very, I'd always heard it's good to go different places, but, I just had such a great, and still do have such a great relationship with Chris that I wanted to stay. And the project was very different. It was like everything in the weeds walleye. Like it was, the Holy Trinity of fisheries, growth, recruitment, mortality. It was all of that for walleyes, looking at stocking methods, harvest regulations, and harvest techniques. I had a chance to work on lots and lots of different side projects. Yeah, it was great. And then just more teaching and mentoring. And so that was, obviously PhDs are such a different degree, and it was just very formative and again, great. And so anyway, I finished up my PhD, and I really had a bad attitude about doing a postdoc. I'll be honest. I was like, crying out loud, I've spent all this time in school. Do I really need to go do a postdoc? Mm-hmm. I came out and was fairly productive in graduate school. So I was like, I really don't need to do this. However, I was looking at some of my peers who were equally productive, and they were getting outcompeted for jobs. And so I was like, all right, I guess I need to go do this. And I was really kind of on the fence. I was like, there are only a few people I'd really like to do a postdoc with. And as I was getting really serious about it, like within a week, there was an advertisement flown on the AFS job board from Wayne Hubert, which was one of the people that was on mm-hmm. my very, very short list of like two people.
Yeah.
And so Wayne had this postdoc and he'd never really had a postdoc before. So it was kind of weird. And he wanted someone, they were looking for someone to come in and develop sampling and assessment techniques for warm water stream fishes in a bunch of the prairie streams, a lot of the great plain streams in Wyoming. And so there you go. Like this was, that's what a lot of what I did, you know, was working on these dicky fish in small streams. And it was great because I was able to bring some of that information back to Wyoming. And anyway, it was a great postdoc, got to work on all kinds of different things, finished up the stream assessment stuff pretty quickly, and then moved on to a bunch of kind of non-game native species work in the upper Colorado River Basin. Yeah. And then went to Iowa State in just a regular faculty position in 2005. So I was on the faculty there for about 5 years. And again, all kinds of different things, pretty diverse program, working very closely with agencies, state and federal agencies. And then I guess most recently in 2010, I moved back to Idaho. So an opportunity, you know, to get into the unit program for one. So my master's, PhD, postdoc was all kind of, you know, my advisors and the people I was working with were all in the unit program. It, you know, pretty much is in the fiber of who I am and how I approach things. So yeah, that opportunity came up. And so I've been here since about 2010. So anyway, that's a roundabout way to answer your question, but.
No, that's awesome. It's really interesting. Yeah. And when we were talking a little bit ahead of the interview, I was thinking about what questions to ask. And you brought up that Chris Guy, when he did his episode with Nick Kramer on the Fisheries Podcast, it was episode 45. I went back and looked it up. He does a great job of explaining like how USGS co-ops work and what you do. So what I was interested for asking you is, where do the research projects typically get started? Do fisheries managers come to you with questions? Do you go to them with questions? A mix of both?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, Chris gave a great, you know, overview of the unit program. Just really quickly, for those that aren't familiar with it, it was developed in the 30s, like mid-30s, I think, really in response to a recognized need for better trained biologists, honestly, and better scientific inquiry into just really hardcore management questions. You know, management being broad, so sport fish as well as you know, fish conservation type stuff. You know, we have a focus on teaching and mentoring. We have a focus on service and outreach, working with professionals, and then, of course, research. And so ideally, all three of those things kind of come together, right? So you have a research program, which involves mentoring of graduate students, which includes, you know, providing a service to an agency. And so the unit program is really diverse. There are people on all spectrums of science and the questions that they ask and the way that they approach it. I have very strong opinions of how the unit should function, but I definitely feel like, you know, I try and adhere to that mission as much as possible. And so, you know, to answer your question, you know, how does research come up? I mean, there are kind of different ways that there are different models of research, right? So, you know, one extreme would be just purely like a consultant type relationship where an agency says, I need this done. This is what you're going to do. Here's the money, do it. The other end of the extreme would be more like an NSF model where it's, okay, I have this idea. I'm going to just try and find money to fund this idea to test this question. My approach is probably is somewhere in the middle, honestly. You know, the nice thing and the reason it works well for me is because my interests are pretty much perfectly aligned with the agencies. So, you know, the questions that I'm interested in are not things that are often left field and things that agencies aren't willing to fund. So a lot of times when my projects, the way that many of my projects emerge is I have great relationships with the managers in Idaho and in other states where I've worked, and just for whatever, you know, just other colleagues that I've met through AFS or whatever the case may be, just contacts. And so a lot of times, you know, they'll come to me and say, you know, hey, we have this question. We're trying to understand this, that, or the other. And then we'll sit and figure out, okay, is this something that fits within my wheelhouse? And if so, then we'll move forward and identify the research questions and move forward from there. Almost all of my projects, I mean, I'm very focused on graduate student education and mentoring. And so all of my projects have graduate students involved with them. And again, there are all kinds of models where people don't have a lot of students or they just have postdocs and this, that, and the other, even within the unit program. But yeah, mine's definitely focused on answering those questions tied to management.
Yeah. And looking at your website, which we'll provide a show link to, you cover a lot of different projects. And so I was curious what's it like to advise such a broad range of projects, and how do you kind of keep track of the ins and outs of each of those?
Who says I keep track of it? I think I'm kind of a jack of many trades and master of a few, so to speak. It's great, honestly, but it is taxing because it's hard to stay up on that much literature, et cetera. I will say, the nice thing is that fisheries tends to be broad anyways. I mean, that's one of the things I really like about fisheries is that, and I joke with our wildlife counterparts because they seem to be like really compartmentalized, right? Like you have the mammal people and the bird people. And even within the mammals, there's the small mammal people, and then there's the large mammal people, and the large mammal folks. Some people focus on ungulates, some work on predators. Geez, and then the bird people are like a whole different crowd. So that's one of the things and not that we don't have our own little factions in fisheries, but we do tend to be more diverse. And I tend to, that's kind of how I approach a lot of questions in fisheries, so to speak. I always tell my students, it doesn't really matter whether you're working on Devil's Hole pupfish or Kootenai River white sturgeon. They're born, they grow, they reproduce, and they die. You know, it's just where, you know, what's regulating those things differed. And that's what we spend our time doing. So I think in a nutshell, you know, I guess that's kind of how I think about things, at least with regards to the population ecology of stuff. And so, yeah, work on a lot of different things, a lot of different systems, different levels of biological organization. It's pretty collaborative, so that helps. That also makes things difficult too.
Yeah.
One of the biologists that I often work with, who actually was one of Chris's students as well, Andy Ducks, he's up in North Idaho. One time we were working on some kokanee work on Lake Ponderay, and the grad student was on there, you know, and it just, everything gets complicated, you know, and Andy looked at me, he's like, man, this would be so much easier if we didn't have a grad student on here. And I looked at him and said, this would be so much easier if I didn't have to work with you guys. And so there's like this back and forth, you know, it's all in good spirit. And of course, you know, the product is way better when we have those collaborations, but it does it, you know, to get at your question. Yeah. It is taxing because, maintaining all those collaborations with different agencies, state, federal, tribal, that often have different interests. You know, ultimately we're all interested in the science, but there's, you know, we all bring our own baggage. And so, yeah, it's definitely a challenge. I think probably the harder part is not the range of projects, it's the range of students and their interests and all of their strengths and weaknesses that they bring to the table, you know, and really focusing on that becomes a challenge. I will say, you know, keeping track of the ins and outs, I think this is, you know, I think the key to that is just being really efficient. I think it's keeping things as simple as possible. I try and structure my program so that I hate administration. I just hate it. And so I don't know who likes it, but, you know, I've tried to compartmentalize my program and my projects so that they're fairly easy to manage. So part of that's by design, and I'm fortunate that the agencies that I work with allow me to do that. You know, so they're well-funded projects. So I'm not having to, you know, bring in 7 grants to answer one question, which makes my life way easier. Keeping really organized, having really good administrative support. You know, we're fortunate in the unit programs where we have really good administrative support with USGS. So, yeah.
Awesome. Do you try to keep the number, like, do you try to stick around a certain number of graduate students to keep it more manageable? Or does it really just depend on like what funding, what projects you have going?
Yeah, good question. So I got as high as 9 students one time, and that was not healthy for me, to be honest with you. I do spend a lot of time with my students. Like that's really important to me. That's why I do what I do. That's why I'm not at a science center or something along those lines, because I really feel like mentoring is what it's all about. And 9 students was tough. Luckily, they were staggered a little bit. So some were at the end of their program, some were in the middle, et cetera. I wish I had a magic number, but it seems like 5 to 6 seems to be a decent number. It's awesome when they're kind of staggered a little bit. So I'm not just dealing with, like, you know, research proposals, you know, half a dozen research proposals all within the same couple of weeks, because that's just like, that takes a lot of work.
Yep.
So yeah, 5 to 6 seems to be pretty good. And I tend to have mostly master students too in my program. And again, that's somewhat by choice. I believe in the mission of the co-op unit, most of the agencies that I work with are mostly hiring master's students as well. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean I don't have PhD students. I certainly do, but I'm certainly more picky, I guess, yeah, when it comes to that.
Yeah. So to switch a little bit back to your research areas, when I was looking through your website, there's some areas that I just selfishly found more interesting and wanted to talk about because it's similar stuff to what I work on. Right. And one of those was your work on these biotic and abiotic factors and how they interact to affect fish populations. And so a really typical example that I always think of as well, changing abiotic conditions like warmer stream temperatures with climate change might facilitate more negative interactions with introduced species. But when I was talking to you about that, you kind of had a reversed thought process with that in some of the papers, which I thought was really interesting, where you look at how biotic interactions like competition or predation could actually override the effects of these abiotic conditions like favorable habitat. So I was wondering, how did you get started along that line of research?
Yeah, this is one of those things that like really goes back and is something that just kind of crops up over my career a few times here and there. And it's always in the back of my mind. And you know, really this whole idea of kind of this interplay between biotic and abiotic factors, as I mentioned, really kind of came up during my master's. Mm-hmm. And when I moved, you know, this Western kid moving to the Midwest, you know, where we've got like almost 40 native species in Idaho, I think is it, you know, and I've, mm-hmm. you know, first time I pulled a seine in Kansas, we had like that many in a seine haul. It was a little overwhelming. So it was like, man, like how does this work? You know, how do these species they have to interact. And so I got really interested in that. And I would say, you know, I really got into the literature on really in the stream ecology literature. So a lot of Bill Matthews' work out of Oklahoma mm-hmm. and Edie Marsh Matthews and Ike Schlosser and Paul Engermeyer and that whole crew and Gary Grossman. So looking at, you know, how abiotic and biotic interactions, you know, work basically. In that case, it was mostly focused on assemblage structure, but nonetheless, like that. So that kind of planted mm-hmm. the idea. You know, the whole idea of hierarchical faunal filters as well is something that kind of crops up in a lot of my research. And it's kind of, I don't know, it's embedded in the way that I think about how these structures or how these systems function. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so that's kind of where I came into my, it's where I was when I kind of came into my PhD. And so my PhD work was looking at recruitment dynamics of walleyes. And I won't go into all the details on it, but I became really interested in how do species interact in a reservoir? It's such a weird thing, right? Like nothing has evolved in a reservoir. So mm-hmm. you can have two native species in a dissimilar habitat, a species in which they have no evolutionary history, or you have non-native species interacting with native species. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, white crappie are native in Kansas, walleyes, it's debatable if they were, it's probably just in the upper Missouri or portion of Missouri that touches mm-hmm. Kansas. But there was, you know, there was some work, earlier work by Ken Carlander over in Iowa and Clear Lake that made some comments about centrarchid predation on walleyes. Shivoni in New York had done some work on black crappie and really showed a lot of the same relationships that we saw through some of our work in Kansas. And it was just published in some little, you know, like New York Fish and Game Journal type mm-hmm. thing. But I remember seeing that. Dave Willis actually pointed it out to me and said, hey, you should take a look at that. Because in Kansas, there was this notion, one of the research biologists I was working really closely with, Jimmy Steven, with Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks, said, you know, when we have good crappie year classes or, you know, lots of small crappies, we tend to not have very good walleye recruitment. And so that, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of had that in the back of my mind. So anyway, we started moving forward and I had some long-term data. Actually, Kansas had a standardized data set that went back to the 70s. So before many states had that, and that was, you know, a tribute to Don Gablehouse and Dave Willis and some others who really got mm-hmm. that started. I was able to capitalize on those data and had, you know, 20 years of standardized data looking at walleye recruitment, abundance of white crappies, and saw this like really striking relationship between basically age zero walleyes, which is a great index to recruitment, a whole series of stuff on that, against stocked to quality length white crappies. So those are 130 to 200 millimeter white crappies, primarily mm-hmm. age one fish. So it's not just what's good for walleye recruitment is bad for white crappies or different years. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we saw this really strong, striking relationship. And it's, you kind of, I guess the best way to describe it is just like an L, right? So if you plot white crappie on the X-axis and walleye on the why, you see this L-shaped relationship where it really functions, it appears to function as an ecological threshold, where once you get, when you have low abundance, for example, of white crappies, you see high variability in the abundance of walleyes. Once you get past that point, you have essentially no walleyes and it's all white crappies. And, you know, if there's no relationship there, you'd expect at least see one point somewhere in the middle, but you never do. 20 years worth of data across, I don't know what it was, 10 different reservoirs or something. And so at the time when I was at K-State, Jim Garvey was there, who's now at Southern Illinois, and he had published a paper, recently published a paper in ecology on nonlinear, kind of nonlinear discontinuous relationships and how to test for those and identify where the threshold was. So like all of these things just kind of came together and was like, wow, we see this really striking relationship with walleyes and white crappie. And so we did some experiments actually to see, you know, what happens with white crappies and larval walleyes. Of course, they're going to eat them, but it was amazing just like how fast we were able to confirm that. We gave it a silly little name and published it in Canadian Journal. Yeah. And, you know, the nice thing about those thresholds and is that it does provide a value, you know, it's really, really is important for management. So the idea here is that if you're below that threshold of white crappie abundance, and there's some better examples I can talk about if you want, but if you're below that threshold, the idea that we have high variability in recruitment of walleyes, most of that variability seems to be driven by abiotic characteristics. Mm-hmm. But once you get past that threshold, if you have a lot of white crappies, it doesn't matter if the stars align with regards to the habitat characteristics, you're just never going to have walleye recruitment. Mm-hmm. And, we kind of put this out there and, you know, more recently I've seen some stuff on walleyes and looking at, you know, it's coming up again where, it does seem like some of these biotic controls on walleye recruitment are a thing. And we certainly didn't invent it. Like I said, I think Chauvin, the credit belongs there, but we certainly saw it. We saw those strong patterns.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and I've done some other work on that too.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any current projects kind of working along this vein of research?
Yeah, I do actually. So yeah, I will mention when I did my postdoc, we kind of found some similar relationships with cutthroat turbid river cyprinids, you know, really these really strong interactions between a non-native and native fish. When I was in Iowa, we found similar patterns with common carp, obviously a non-native fish, and sport fishes. And interestingly there, that's unlikely a direct interaction between carp either competing or preying on sport fish. It's a, you know, kind of a habitat mediated thing. So you've got carp that are changing the habitat characteristics.
Oh yeah.
To a point where it does function as a threshold, plain and simple. It's clear as day. Yeah. In terms of recent work. So I just brought on a new graduate student, Nick Voss, actually, who you probably know. He's from, just wrapped up at Montana State doing some smallmouth work on the Yellowstone. So we got a project working with the state office, with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Idaho Fish and Game is engaged in it as well, trying to better understand kind of the interaction. It was a very open-ended question. This was one of those ones where it's like, okay, we want to know something about brook trout and bull trout. And so, you know, the sideboards on this project are wide and small, so we can do all kinds of different things, right? But really, we're trying to look at bull trout and brook trout. And so Nick, you know, he's like super gung-ho. He's like, okay, let's get in. Let's see what we can find for existing data to just see what some of this, what this looks like. And so he's able to work. He's working with Fish and Game anyway to get these long-term, spatially extensive data really across the entire state, both snorkeling and electrofishing data, working with Forest Service. Anyway, lots and lots and lots of information on bull trout. And so he's went through and you kind of truncate the data set to say, okay, we don't want to be too high or too low in elevation. So kind of work within the environmental envelope, so to speak, of bull trout, like where could they be? Where could brook trout be? And then you just look at a bivariate plot. And I told him before he did it, I said, I won't be surprised if it looks like this. And I drew it on a piece of paper and he comes in and he's like, yeah, look at this. And sure enough, it's exactly what it looked like. And so, you know, there is this really strong relationship between brook trout and bull trout. And it's, I'll be honest, it's not a great story. It's looking like when you calculate where that threshold point actually occurs, at what point do you not see bull trout? It's pretty much a binary thing. It's basically, if you've got brook trout, you pretty much don't have bull trout. So, you know, this is pretty descriptive. He's given a talk on it for AFS and going to be working on a paper here pretty soon, just to throw this out there. But Yeah, it's pretty interesting. And so some of the questions that we're trying to ask, there are all kinds of questions wrapped up in brook trout, mm-hmm. bull trout. But one of the questions we're trying to ask is, and I think we've answered it, is does that threshold vary depending on habitat characteristics? So for example, is that relationship only strong in first and second order streams, third order streams? And then as you get into bigger systems, does that kind of start to fall apart? You know, mm-hmm. where you can have a lot of bull trout and a lot of brook trout.
Yeah.
The answer is no. Like it doesn't matter what perspective you look at this, like that relationship is just really strong. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of it could be a habitat thing. Like that's one criticism of this relationship, or I guess one argument is say, well, it's just showing what's good for brook trout, you know, where you have abundant brook trout and not many bull trout, just because the habitat's not good for bull trout, right? Mm-hmm. Or vice versa. We see these same patterns with cutthroat trout, for example, yeah. and brown trout and brook trout or rainbows, you know, as the non-native, so to speak. And my response to that is that, you know, that experiment has been done. In fact, entire like conservation strategies are based on the assumption that that's not true. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, we have examples where we as a profession or agencies have went in and, you know, whatever, remove brook trout, remove rainbow trout, remove brown trout with, you know, build a barrier, nuke it upstream with rotten owner Annamycin for mm-hmm. a series of years, go back, stock cutthroat trout, and guess what? They do great. So you haven't changed the habitat. All you've changed right. is the biotic interaction. So I think the experiments have been done in many cases, but, you know, there's still lots of questions like what, mm-hmm. you know, what scale do these occur? What's driving it? What's the mechanism with bull trout, brook trout? I don't feel like we have a clear idea of the mechanism. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's some of the stuff Nick's going to be working on over the next 4 years. So yeah, it's kind of fun to come back to this because, you know, there's kind of some fluffy ecology tied to this, I would say, but there's also some real management applications with regard to, you know, what this means for conservation of bull trout, you know, mm-hmm. provide some management targets for, you know, brook trout suppression or brook trout abundance.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you think in general, species that might have evolved with competition would be better prepared to I guess I'm thinking like with most cutthroat species, it seems like they didn't really evolve with competition. So it's not as surprising to me that when you have these introduced species that did evolve with competition, that they're getting beat out. But it surprises me a little bit more with bull trout that are really good competitors, that they're also kind of getting beat out by these non-natives. So do you think the evolutionary history of these fish has anything to do with like how this relationship plays out?
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. It's a really insightful question. And I wish I had a good answer, but I don't know. You know, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, like cutthroat and bull trout didn't evolve with many species.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, pretty depauperate systems, but I think, you know, we do see some of these same relationships with other species, like in the Midwest, you know, mm-hmm. like I mentioned with carp and some of these other, you know, bluegill and largemouth bass. Walleyes evolved with lots, certainly way more than many of the salmonids. I don't know. I really, potentially, you know, it assumes that interaction, you know, that question kind of assumes a little bit that the mechanism mm-hmm. is competitive interactions, perhaps.
Right.
I think predation is a major component of it. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the issues, and the reason I guess I have a hard time answering this is because a little bit of this is, I don't think it's confirmation bias, but like we see the patterns where we see those are when there is a really strong interaction.
Yeah.
And so in situations where we, you know, where a species, for example, is able to fend off a competitor or predator, like we don't see that type of pattern and they kind of hang on. I think a lot of these systems where we're seeing these are just really, really, really strong interactions. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So yeah. I think that's part of it. I think that the other part of it is pretty much all of the systems where I have seen this have been in systems where you're either dealing with a native versus a non-native species. And then that native species, for whatever reason, like that's, you know, a multi-million dollar question. Why do some mm-hmm. of these native species take off in some areas, but not others? Yeah. But when they do, boy, they just put the hammer down and it's a problem. You know, look at cutthroat and lake trout, you know, across the West. Some, you know, when they're a problem, they're really a problem. And then you do see these really strong interactions. So you do see these, I think you end up with these novel species interactions. So it's really, I would agree with you. Maybe those species that have evolved with more species and are kind of able to, quote, deal with multiple competitors or predators, maybe be better able to fend that off. But mm-hmm. at least in the data that I've seen, it's hard to come to that conclusion per se.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like there are these novel species interactions or situations where the habitat is, I guess, novel, so to speak, like a reservoir. Mm-hmm. But it does raise all kinds of questions with changing environmental conditions and climate.
Yeah.
In particular, you know, you start changing the playing field and that changes the whole nature of those interactions. And there's a whole literature out there in terms of, you know, how biotic versus abiotic characteristics vary depending on the scale and the spatial scale, the temporal scale, et cetera. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Has much of this work, or do you know of anyone that's done work that looks at interactions between two native species and seeing if this relationship still exists?
No, I haven't. I have a little file that I keep put away and I haven't seen one. You know, Phaedra Booty, who's at mm-hmm. Utah State, some of her students have seen patterns with bluehead suckers and brown trout, I believe, these same kind of patterns. Yeah, there's some others, but it's almost always one of these goofy things, which, you know, let's be honest. I mean, one of the major factors facing fisheries are invasive species. Yeah. So it's super relevant. Like I said, I keep a file because I need one of these days when I'm not dealing with editing theses and stuff, you know, I need to write a bigger paper on,
yeah.
on this. Maybe I'll let Nick do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't seen one with a native versus native because I think they are able to sort it out. Like, I don't yeah. think you have those super strong interactions. You know, you could see where, you know, the environment might change and that tips it. So maybe we'll start seeing some mm-hmm. of those patterns.
Yeah, I was just curious. I did my senior thesis on West Slope cutthroat and bull trout. I mean, it was broader than that, but it was involving those two species. And we had a similar L-shaped type curve. And it was really just like, if there was enough pools, then you could still see West Slope cutthroat with bull trout. But if there was fewer pools, then we didn't see West right. Slope with bull trout. And so I was just like, that was a fairly obviously small system that we were looking right. at. But I was just curious if there was other examples similar to that.
Yeah. And that might be an example where you do have changing characteristics where, you know, one fish is getting a squeeze or, you know, the environmental characteristics, say temperatures are warming and that's bad for bull trout. And they're just mm-hmm. not able, you know, maybe that slows down their growth, for example, and therefore they're unable to compete as well with West Slope. So West Slopes yeah. would take over and you'd see that same type of pattern perhaps, but mm-hmm. yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. You know, like I said, it crops up a lot with invasive species. And yeah. you think about it, it's like, yeah, you know, when a species is a problem, it's because it's having such a strong interactive effect right. on another species.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, I will switch gears from research because I also really wanted to ask you, we talked about having a few questions about graduate school and mentoring, and I yeah. really want to make sure we hit those. So I guess starting for people who are maybe just graduating undergrad or at the end of their undergraduate degree, when should people start looking at options for graduate school and what's typically the best way to go about applying?
Yeah, this is kind of near and dear. It seems like I've been having this discussion a lot with people. I just filled 3 master's projects starting in January. So it mm-hmm. seems like I end up talking to students, even if I don't take them on about yeah. like grad school, because they ask me questions about it. And anyway. Yeah, I think, you know, that really, it really varies depending on the student, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's one of those things, you know, my advice for students is start looking at graduate programs when you're ready. Mm-hmm. And if you're not sure when that is, then you're not ready.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think for those of us that went on to grad school, we knew it was time for that next step in our career and felt like that was important. I think, you know, the best way to go about applying. So there are lots of different opinions on this. Al Zale has a great paper mm-hmm. that he wrote. I can't remember when that was published. 2000s.
Yeah.
In fisheries. And so there's that. That's a good one for folks to go and look at. And Al talks a lot about graduate school and what it's about and how to get there. And I generally agree with most of that stuff. You know, as far as my program goes, you know, I guess I would say in general in fisheries, you know, it's for those people, for undergrads out there that may be listening to this, you know, graduate school in fisheries is more like a job, truthfully, than an mm-hmm. undergrad. Like, you couldn't pay me enough to do another undergrad when I finished my undergrad, but I knew what grad school was about, you know, so, you know, there's a stipend and usually your tuition and all of those things are covered. So it's definitely more like a job. The application process is very different. So, you know, when I get a graduate, so when I go forward and I get a grant to do a research project, you know, it's a lot of time and effort on my part and the folks that I'm working with to put that together. And it's expensive. You know, a graduate program, you know, a master's project can be anywhere from $120,000 to $200,000 if it's mm-hmm. field-based and lab-based. So I'm not just going to take the first person that, you know, sends me a note. I spend a lot of time in kind of ferreting out, you know, and vetting students. Mm-hmm. And so I often tell undergrads, you know, once they're really ready for graduate school, you know, kind of think a little bit about, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? That's going to dictate a little bit of the type of person that you work with. Mm-hmm. For sure, because they're typically going to have projects that are going to be one of interest and are going to give you the skills that you need to be successful in whatever you choose to do. So, you know, usually I encourage students to contact potential advisors beforehand, you know, mm-hmm. with just a short email, include a CV, all those things. And then if people have projects, they're going to let you know. If not, they may, you know, when I get people contact me, I just, if I don't have anything, I just have a file and I hold on to those. And then if a project comes up, a lot of times I don't advertise projects because I have really good people that are contacting me mm-hmm. and already in the mix. Sometimes I will advertise projects, but again, people have different approaches to that.
Yeah.
So I usually strike up a conversation, and if there's a project, then we move forward from there.
Mm-hmm. So once you have a graduate student in your lab, what tips would you have, or I guess any person who's in a graduate program right now, what tips do you have for them to get the most out of their experience as a student?
Learn how to juggle. You know, grad school comes in fits and starts, so to speak. Yeah. It's very cyclic. And there are times when you just can't be you can't be more busy than you are. And other times you're like, man, I really don't want to start this because mm-hmm. I don't have time for it. So learning to juggle is important. I think developing really good organizational skills is one way to do that. I think that helps one just stay organized, and that helps you be efficient. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, your earlier comment about how do I kind of maintain things and keep track of everything. I think I'm a pretty efficient person, and that's just like, that has taken a lot of time and effort to get to that point. But mm-hmm. I think focusing on efficiency is huge. You know, grad school's tough too. And I, at least in my lab, you know, I have pretty high expectations for my students. I think that's pretty clear. They know that coming in. So, but they have high expectations for themselves. So those are the types mm-hmm. of students that I tend to bring on. And so working hard obviously goes without question. And I do think that like a lack of academic horsepower, I'm a good example of this. Like, I'm not a very smart person, but I work hard. I think a lot can be overcome by working hard. And again, working on some of those skills, you know, strengthening your strengths and strengthening your weaknesses as well, and identifying what those are. And truthfully, you know, I mean, there's nothing more important when thinking about graduate school than who you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
The project doesn't really matter, to be honest with you. I mean, of course, if you don't want to do genetics for your profession, then don't work on a genetics project. But again, you know, identifying a group of potential advisors and mentors is critically important, in my opinion. And then, you know, because they're typically going to have projects that you're interested in, but a good mentor is going to help you, you know, is going to help facilitate those things. You know, mm-hmm. if they're really invested in you and your success, then they're going to help you be successful. You know, ultimately it's on your shoulders, but yeah, that's kind of what it's all about, in my opinion.
Yeah. Do you have any tips for mentoring, either if it's graduate students mentoring undergrads or for new faculty mentors starting with their first graduate students?
Yeah. I mean, again, mentoring is like center for me, honestly, mm-hmm. for working with my grad students. There's just nothing more important because I'm a benefit of all that. I've had great mentors and still have great mentors. I still talk to people that I've worked with on a regular basis. I get mm-hmm. mentoring from my students, truthfully. So, you know, I would say the biggest thing is you need, I guess, a couple of things. One is that you need a receptive mentee. So you need students or whoever you're mentoring, you know, that person needs to be receptive to it. I think mm-hmm. the other thing is it really requires this may sound a little fluffy, but requires kind of a genuine kind of collegial relationship. Like there has to be kind of a bit of a friendship there at first. I, you know, that's one of the reasons I always meet with my grads. Like I interview and visit with potential students beforehand, like in person, if I can. I just think it's so important to just see if that chemistry is there because, you know, again, you need to have that mutual, I guess, kind of that friendship. You have to have trust. I do think people in my position, I think, you know, being humble and not being selfish is really important. I once heard that to really be successful as a mentor, particularly in academia, you have to be willing to give away your best ideas. And there's a lot of truth in that. You know, you just have to put your ego aside and figure out, okay, why am I in this? And if it truly is about your students, then you have to be willing to give them everything and let them have the spotlight and all those things. And that truthfully, you know, I'm at a point that's infinitely more rewarding to me to see them be successful than anything I get. But yeah, I think that's a big part of it. You know, I think it's really about a commitment, like a genuine commitment, not just, I'm going to mentor this person because it's important. And, you know, and the best advisors out there are people that consistently have good students, consistently are successful and whatnot. And I have such a long list of mentors that I'm just so thankful for. They've taught me a lot. So, and I think a mentor needs to be willing to admit when they're wrong too. You know, it's a lot like parenting as I've become, we have two daughters and the parallels between like mentoring graduate students and parenting are uncanny. So I've learned a lot from both of those things, but like I've made some major mistakes mentoring, you know, with students, I think, and, you know, not handled situations the best way that I should have. And I hope anyway that I've learned from that and is able to say, yeah, I was wrong. That was, that was messed up, and talk to the students and work through it. So I think that's important too.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyhow.
Yeah, that was great. One question I always like to touch on with people is kind of asking about their interests outside of fisheries and conservation. And we touched on a couple of your hobbies in the intro. So I was kind of curious, how do you approach a work-life balance, especially as like a professor when you have so many things going on? How do you try to approach that?
I'm probably not the best person to ask. I've had periods where, it has not been balanced. Yeah. And generally more on the work side. I mean, I'm a workaholic by nature, and I don't know. I think once we had kids, that really helped me like kind of settle down a little bit and really focus on just what's important and what's not in life. And I think, you know, I have a lot of hobbies, probably too many hobbies. And so that helps me a lot, honestly. Mm-hmm. There's the movie Christopher Robin about Winnie the Pooh. Winnie the Pooh says, doing nothing often leads to the very best something. I love that quote because it's right. Like, I think having times when you just unplug from work is huge, and just letting your mind just do what it needs to do to relax and let your subconscious work on problems that you're facing, those kinds of things. Yeah, it's, you know, I think part of it is just knowing your limits, you know, and knowing what you can and can't handle. And that's hard, particularly once you get started. I'm kind of to a point in my career where I know what I can and can't do and what I can and can't expect from students and those kinds of, I mean, I'm still learning, don't get me wrong, but I think it's just something everyone has to figure out for themselves.
But
it's tough. Like, I mean, that's probably one of the biggest challenges, honestly. You know, the science is comparatively easy. Administration is comparatively easy, like those things. But figuring out that balance between work and life is hard. And particularly in academia, you know, these are competitive positions. You know, we have awesome jobs and people want them. And so to get to that point, like it's a lot of sacrifice. It's a lot of hard work, and that's just what it takes. And so it's hard to throttle back a little bit sometimes, but you have to, you know, I mean, it's just fish, right? Yeah. There are more important things out there.
Just fish.
It's just fish. Tongue in cheek.
Yeah.
It is important. But
is there anything else you wanted to cover before we hit our final few questions?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Not unless you have any additional questions.
No, we covered all of mine, which I was pretty excited about. So. All right.
Okay, good.
Awesome. Well, what we call the tough part of the interview is over. I don't know if I actually believe it's the tough part of the interview. So that brings us to our final five questions, which we ask each guest that comes on the show. And the first one is, what is your favorite fish?
Yeah, I knew this was coming. And I'm not going to pick one. I will say my favorite fish to hate are either walleye or largemouth bass. because everyone loves them. So it gives me a little joy and poking fun at people that love walleyes.
Yeah.
And I've done a ton of work on them. In fact, I'm still doing research on walleyes. They just, I can't get away from it. My favorite fish to catch is steelhead, without doubt. It's like, it's probably one of the only things I'm good at, actually, is like marginally good at, is catching steelhead. But in general, I would say my favorite fish is an entire family, and those are suckers. I love catastomids. They just make the world go round in rivers, plain and simple. And I try and work on them whenever I can. I was lucky when I was in Wyoming, I got to work on flannel mouth suckers and blueheads. And so, like, if I had to pick a species, it's probably my, I mean, anadromous fish are cool just because, like, it's pretty remarkable what they do physiologically and whatnot. But, like, if I really had to pick a group, catastomids, and I love bluehead suckers just because I've done a lot of work on them, got a chance to work on them before it was cool to work on them. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Blue I suckers love suckers.
Are cool. Blue suckers are cool.
Yep.
They're all really neat. Yeah. I had a great, in the Midwest when I was in Iowa, we got to do a fair bit of sucker work kind of on the side. And it was just, it was a blast. So
I went on many rants in undergrad about how awesome suckers were because everyone was so distracted by the trout. And so I'm excited to hear that.
Well, they do. I mean, if you look at biomass and rivers, like they make the world go round.
Yeah.
And like we've been doing some work up on the Kootenai that really shows that's a whole nother interesting area of discussion of like levels of biological organization. Where do you see a signal for management, right? Like, do you see that at the assemblage level, population level? Sometimes not. Sometimes you see it in growth. And we've seen that with catastomids up in the Kootenai, for example, where like they just have this really strong signal to some of the management applications that are being done. And they've just generally been ignored.
Yeah.
Yeah. They don't get a lot of love, but maybe that'll change.
I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Okay. Our second question is, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh, so many. Yeah. I've been so many places, worked with so many awesome people. It's really hard to pick one, but you know, when I think back in my mind's eye, okay, like what's kind of a formative thing? I would have to say it's probably some of my sturgeon work, shovel nose sturgeon work on the Kansas River during my master's work. And I think a couple of reasons for that, like it was all side project stuff. So it wasn't tied to my master's work, which was, you know, we had specific questions that we needed to ask and answer with regards to that portion of my thesis. But the sturgeon stuff was just totally on the side. Chris put a lot of, you know, faith in me, so to speak, to go out and work on this stuff. And so it was really my first project, really the first project that was on my own. Mm-hmm. It was my first age and growth study, which, you know, that's one of my passions, do a ton of work on age and growth. It was working on shovel nose sturgeon before working on shovel nose sturgeon was cool. Like it was like right, you know, at the knife's edge on a lot of that stuff. And probably my best like memory of that was one time when Chris came out with me in the field and we were sampling, we were drifting trammel nets. I don't know if you've ever done that, but it's one of the most fun things to do. It's also one of the worst things to do, like if it gets snagged up. Oh, and so we were setting these small little trammel nets out of this little dinky John boat, like right below this bridge on Fort Riley. And so like, there's all kinds of crap in the river from the fort. Like you just never know what you're going to find. And so we're in there and Chris is out there and all of a sudden the net, you know, it's floating along and then just collapses. And we're like, oh, you gotta be kidding me. So he pulls this thing up and he just starts freaking out because there's like this green box, like army box with hoses coming out and all kinds of stuff. So it was really hilarious, first of all, but it was just fun, you know, honestly, because it was pretty early in my graduate career. And so it seems silly, but like that was something that was just really important in my relationship with Chris. It was like, yeah, okay, this is just a normal guy.
Yeah.
You know, he is, but he isn't, you know, he's my advisor and I have a ton of respect for Chris. I did then, I do now, but it really helped me relate to him in a lot of ways, which was really important for me. And I think that's just important in general, because I think, you know, so much of what we've already talked about, you know, so much of what we do is about relationships. So anyway, that was pretty formative. Some of my other, you know, I just have when my students graduate and finish up, like, it's just awesome. I mean, those are always, every one of them is a favorite memory. So.
All right. What is your dream job and location?
I have it already. Yeah. I mean, the chance to do really applied work that's appreciated by agencies. I work a lot with Idaho Fish and Game, and they're just, it's such a stellar agency. I mean, they really put their money where their mouth is when it comes to using science to guide management. And so like I really can't ask for anything better, you know. I mean, I love living in Idaho, but more than that, you know, I get to do applied work. I'm able to recruit awesome students that just do great things and great work, and they're super integrated with the agency and the research program. And yeah, I wish everyone could have what we have here because it's just really great.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I definitely have it. And they're steelhead, like.
Okay. If money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
Yeah, so many. I love suckers and I love agent growth work. So it'd probably be, I would love to do some large scale studies of looking at, you know, the Holy Trinity, growth, recruitment, mortality of catastomids across a wide range of systems. You know, I'm particularly interested in, you know, particularly at a regional level, do you see synchrony, for example, in recruitment dynamics as it's related to kind of larger scale habitat? I'm kind of with that approach. You could also ask smaller scale questions about what's really driving the pop dynamics of these critters. Again, they're just such an important component, particularly in river. And I do a lot of work in reservoirs and lakes, but I'm definitely a stream and river guy at heart, I think.
Yeah.
And so I think kind of knowing what makes them tick would be cool. And I've actually thought about going down that road. You know, I'm going to get all kinds of, who knows what kind of comments I'm going to get from my colleagues here in Idaho about wanting to study suckers. but yeah, I think that would be kind of fun. Yeah. Agencies aren't going to fund that. That would be an NSF type thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I do, there's some interesting questions with regards to suppression, like suppression techniques and compensatory responses. That's something that really keeps cropping up in a lot of work we do. It's like, okay, you know, what are those density dependent processes after these suppression programs? What, how do populations compensate? Cause that is super relevant for a lot of work that's going on out here in the West. Anyway, yeah, I could go on forever. There are all kinds of questions that'd be fun to work on, but I'm going to say suckers and growth, because those are two things near and dear to my heart.
Awesome. Okay. Our last question is, if there's one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
You know, I can't help but say just like work hard. You know, we have very important jobs, and so you have to take your work really seriously, but at the same time, you know, be a good human being.
Yeah.
It sounds silly, but yeah, so many problems everywhere could just be solved if people would just be decent. And anyway, yeah, got a sign in my yard that says be kind. Yeah, that's kind of the principle of things in many ways.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It was really fun hearing about all of your work and your experiences and the advice you had. If people want to find out more information about your projects or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
Yeah. So I have a website and you should be able to provide a link to that. Yep. So that's just to my lab stuff. So there's all kinds of things on there. I do have an Instagram account. However, if you go on there, it's mostly going to be pictures of woodworking and giant steelhead. So if you like that, you can look there. I do have some occasional work stuff that gets posted on there. Not much in the last couple of years, because I haven't been in the field a whole lot with COVID. So that's been tricky, but yeah,
okay.
So that'll work.
Great. Yeah. I'll include those in the show notes.
Thanks.
If you'd like to get a hold of me or the podcast, you can find me at KB Heinle on Twitter, and the podcast is on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or you can send us an email at feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you all enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Katie Heinle. Thank you for listening to the 149th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, work hard, take your work seriously, and be a decent human being.